code of whatever taste that enables you to talk about it, to talk about it, right? Like, when I think about, like, I had this experience when I was taking liberal studies classes, where, because in liberal studies, we, you know, we read texts, but we also are looking at visual works and sometimes even music. But I had this experience where we were looking at a painting of Dante and Beatrice, and it's the painting where Dante is kind of like looking down at Beatrice, and Beatrice is like removing her veil and looking up. And we were told to describe it. So, like, write as much as we can about what we see. And I used, so, and the background is, it's kind of like a floral background with certain patterns and stuff. But I used the word arabesque, right? Which is a term, it's a term from, coming from, like, Arab and Muslim art, because they have a lot of like geometric designs and they use floral art a lot. So I use the word arabesque, and the professor commented on that, and I learned, and the sort of the lesson here is that I kind of learned that that's like a cultured thing to say, right? Like, when you're describing these things, you should use the word arabesque because that's the right word to use. You don't just say that it's like a flower background or something. It's arabesque. That communicates that you are educated about these, that you know what you're talking about, right?
Yes. So in the sense, like, both like literally and metaphorically, there's a cultural language, and like you need to be able to speak that cultural language. There's actually a really great line in the piece where it just says, taste classifies and it classifies the classifier, right? Like, taste classifies things as really, really great or really, really bad, they're really good taste or really bad taste or whatever. But it also, like, in one's ability to have that kind of taste, right, to be one of the, you know, of the taste, such a funny way of saying it, but that it also, you know, designates the kind of person that you are. And exactly like you said, right, like, if you're using these kind of like esoteric or very technical terms in, you know, description of something like art, well, then you're revealing, you know, a kind of knowledge and ability that's going to be appreciated and understood by other people who are super into art, and by extension, going back to the, like, kind of, like, you know, more secondary connection economically, well, what kind of people are super interested in art, right? It's not usually people who are, you know, stuck in mines making a dollar a day, or, you know, like, in sweatshops or wherever it might be, right? Like, you know, it's an educated and an elite class. And Rodin definitely believes that, like, the culture has this a directionality from the elites, right? That the elites kind of are the spearhead of culture, and then it sort of like filters down and eventually becomes sort of like derivative and sort of, and then, you know, and then find something else, right? I think that's kind of like an older perspective on culture that even he's like maybe resurrecting. I'm not sure, like, so sure, but it is like, he definitely has, there's definitely this elitism to like high culture, which is directly connected with also being the, you know, having lots of economic capital and social capital and, you know, and all the other stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because as much as he's talking about, and we're kind of talking about, how there's a certain kind of elitism, if you look at the theory itself, they're almost, it feels like it shouldn't necessarily be an elitism, because when he talks about the person who is actually able to cultivate these things, he says that, yes, it's through education and you have to have a certain economic standard to be able to engage in that education. But one of the other sociological facts that he says that enables a person to acquire taste is when they come from a wealthy enough household, right? And the interesting thing about that is that if you are born into a wealthy enough household, it's not just that you went to a school to learn this particular language. You actually were born into it. And this is talking about, it kind of goes back to the quandary a little bit of what I was saying, is that you are living into a direct experience that actually comes off as authentic, and you actually delight in these things, and that delight itself is productive of the language. There's this interesting kind of he almost sets up like a golden mean kind of situation where he talks about this, the relation of this properly educated or properly raised person in relation to what he says, the pedant and the mundane. Yeah, the mundane. So the pedant is the person who wasn't really born into this flavor or into this particular taste, but went to school, right? And they understand without feeling. But the mundane is a person who has had certain experiences, but doesn't have that code or that cipher that we've been talking about, right? Yeah, they feel, but they don't understand, right? They have the experiences, but they don't have the language to talk about it. Everything is just ineffable for them. Whereas the person who is born into the right household, and it's not just an education, it is one where one can actually be surrounded by culture as they are born and raised, they have both. They have the experiences, they have the feelings, but since they were born into that, they were raised in that language and are actually able to articulate it, right? So education is an important part of it, but it's education at the household level. And that is really where the class kind of disparity for, and that's why I think in a certain way, elitism is the right term, because your household has to be a certain way. But it also opens the door when we talk about cultural capital, not just in terms of like elitist tastes, right? I think this is why Bourdieu's theory is really good for explaining the proliferation of different kinds of cultures that people can be born into, not just, you know, highfalutin, you know, classical music listening families, but like there's a certain kind of cultural capital to being into, rock music, or being into all kinds of others like subcultures that have cultural capital now in our present media landscape.
By reconciling reason and sensibility, the pedant who understands without feeling and the mundane who enjoys without understanding defines the accomplished individual. So basically, like, if you can combine those two things, like exactly what you're saying, if you can be one who understands, who's got that kind of navel-gazing understanding with a more like technical appreciation, all kind of stuff, but has also found stuff too at the same time that also has this more almost, you know, you can't really put your finger on it so much as, you know, this sort of sublime element, right, of like the good work of art or cultural artifact or whatever it might be, right? That's the person of true appreciation and enjoyment. And then I think what you were getting to as well, though, which kind of reminds me of the other piece that we read as an aside to this by Die Workwear, was that there is this aspect of elitism, and also to, like, this was written, I think, in like 1970 or something like that. But, you know, Die Workwear points out that, you know, in many ways, Bourdieu's structure still stands. However, with the advent of the internet and the democratization and, you know, kind of opening up a globalization of the sphere of public discourse and the sharing of information, that now, you know, the same sort of structure, the same sort of elitism has become like greatly fragmented, because now there's so many different, you could effectively call them schools of interest, right? And whether it's what, you know, and all those different schools, all the different places, all those different communities, they all have things of good taste and things of bad taste, right? And so, like, sure, you do have to enter and be a part of them, but you don't necessarily now have to be like part of the economic elite in many cases to be meaningful and serious participants like maybe you did before, because like you can enter like, you know, the world of like budget streetwear and punk culture and be culturally successful while not economically having much standing.
Yeah, I mean, in a certain way, like especially with something like maybe punk culture or something like that, economic standing might even be like a detriment. Like I can think of memes where people are like texting their parents to ask for money to go buy, you know, yeah, stuff like that. It doesn't, you know, that's not the vibe when you're trying to be, you know, kind of grunge or crust punk or whatever, you know, that you're only doing it because you can afford it. If you really want to be born into and raised with that taste, it does have to come from that household. But that household is at a different sort of economic standing, but it's the appropriate economic standing for that particular kind of taste, right? People of different economic standings might, by that necessity, engage in different like culinary practices or like clothing or listening to different kind of music or something like that. I can think of like certain examples even where it's like think about like there's this really interesting thing that I noticed with gamers, right? And the difference between black gamers and white gamers, where the white gamers, because they have like, they're generally better well off, they can, you know, they can afford the expensive like Nintendo consoles, right? But black gamers more focused on or like played the Sega Genesis or different kinds of consoles, right? And so they engage with different titles because they were priced down at different, you know, they had different pricings. The games were a little more like less expensive. They have different formats. So you're going to have like different experiences. So you're going to develop different kinds of taste in even like between black and white gamers, right? Just by virtue of that.
Yeah, just by virtue of that, exactly. And I think that that's sort of that kind of what's the term like, but the kind of these all these different cultural spheres and bubbles popping up allow, you know, takes the sort of elitism out of it, or at least like degrades it to so that it's more kind of, I guess you could say, like localized, right? But I do still think that it's this interesting, it kind of like gets this interesting question about like taste, right? Like, because the one thing that I really personally revealing don't like is like the subjectivity of like good taste or art. Like art is subjective, right? Like I, you know, it's an idea that I've struggled with myself, but I'm also someone who like likes art and enjoys going to art galleries and appreciates all that kind of stuff to like a relatively casual level, but I do. Like to hear that art, you know, when someone says, oh, art is just subjective, or, you know, nothing's really ugly or nothing's really beautiful. You know, I find that to be like kind of like not just sort of like, so it's kind of self-evident that things are. But I think that the way in which, in contrast with the old Lacantian view of this sort of like self-evident, just like aspect of the sublime that you get in like Critique and Judgment, like instead there's more of this emphasis on a kind of cultural understanding that like basically on some level it's like, can you explain why it's good, right? Okay, well, here are the boundaries of like this particular subculture, right? Whether it's okay, like take the example of like, you know, video games, whether it's like white or black, whoever video game players, okay, like why is this particular video game like really, really good? And why are players of this particular video game who are really good at the game considered like really, you know, kind of like elite with, I guess, within their own little like subculture? Well, there's like reasons and demonstrations for why that actually like is the case and isn't just some like random selection. And those are going to have like, and those do have like historical aspects as well.
Yeah. Yeah. They have historical natural causes that have, you know, it's not just essentialist in the terms of like, well, cause that's the thing is like, if everything was just subjective, like people say that kind of as a response to this idea that, well, what I think is just like what I think is good and what you think is just what you think is good. And so it kind of like essentializes what I think, and it essentializes what you think as like these two things that exist but are incommensurable, right? But what Bourdieu is trying to do is trying to say that actually the thing that you think you have is not even really a thing. You are kind of a drop in a stream of culture, in a stream of tastes that have been developing over time, right? For natural causes. And you were raised to think that this was good. And not necessarily, this is obviously not him saying that nothing is actually good. He's trying to explain the phenomena that we do experience, because the reason that we posit all of these like relativist or essentialist theories is because we really do think something is at stake, right? He's trying to explain where we get our, he's trying to explain where we get the stakes of what we think, right? They come from our education, and specifically what kind of like how we break up the world normatively, right? Because this is kind of the element that we hinted at earlier, but now maybe we can get into, is this idea that these tastes are supposed to separate out kind of how things are for us, what is good and what is bad, right? It's one thing to just have tastes develop from like particular situations or economic backgrounds and whatnot, but they do this in order that our tastes kind of reflect what that economic background says is good. Or
there is absolutely that kind of like reflection going on. And there's also too, yes, these things are beautiful. Or for example, the classical music is beautiful, but like true appreciation can only come from having this particular kind of relationship, which almost certainly requires certain kinds of capital that only certain kinds of people have. But also, too, there's always this kind of like incompleteness of understanding. And I kind of get that actually from like the end. He has the last section of the reading is kind of interesting, because he basically, I'll read it out, but he goes, "There is no way of the game of culture," and so the game of culture is like basically the web of cultural meaning, of just like cultural generally pervading, operating through, like we all do every day, "the game of culture, and one's only chance of objectifying the true nature of the game is to objectify as fully as possible the very operations which one is obliged to use in order to achieve the objectification." So basically, like, even understand the culture, like the tools that you have for cultural investigation are also components of culture themselves, right? And, you know, so he goes on to say, "Paradoxically, the games of culture are protected against objectification by all partial objectifications which the actors involved in the games perform on each other. The law of mutual lucidity and reflexive blindness governs the antagonism between intellectuals and the bourgeoisie." I don't want to get into that too much, but basically there's always, he kind of like hints that there always, in cultural understanding, there's always going to be some degree of blindness, because you're always going to have some sort of position within the cultural web. And even if that's a position of great understanding on some particular topic, or you're some sort of elite or whatever it might be, you're always going to be in opposition to someone else's interpretation and understanding and all that kind of stuff. And so by that very nature, you're not going to have a complete understanding of some sort of cultural artifact or, you know, classification or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting. I think specifically the interesting bit here is that there is something kind of self-effacing about, well, yes, there is something self-effacing about our particular taste, that they always suggest something about ours and to the exclusion of others. The interesting thing here for Bourdieu, as a sociologist, is that, I mean, he is raised within a particular education and taught how to conduct himself. So he's even kind of being disciplinarily reflexive in that sense, that even this is a kind of, yeah, even this is like a particular taste of sociology, right? And it almost kind of speaks to, because it's one thing for sociologists to discuss Bordeaux. You know, he's a really important figure in, you know, cultural studies and whatnot. But for us as philosophers, I think it's really interesting to be taking Bordeaux. And it kind of reflects our taste a little bit too, I think, that it says something that philosophers kind of interested in this particular field or in this, in topics of like, you know, present media or, you know, contemporary philosophy, phenomenology, existentialism, find something important about this. Because not all philosophers would think that this is important or think that this reflects like the right way to go about doing philosophy, you know?
Kind of reminds me a little bit of the other work, of Thy Workwear a little bit, where it kind of says, okay, well, it's a more practical guide in terms of like, if this is like, if this is how we're going to interact and understand cultural aspects, then like, you know, how do you develop ultimately if there's, you know, taste? How do you develop like good taste? What does that actually like look like? Basically, you have to learn the language, but you have to learn the language in your own way too. And again, it's this kind of like the split that you almost hinted at earlier with the sort of like, you both have the understanding and the sublime of experience. Start with a structure that's already there. You know, and he also says, like, think of fashion in this case, because he's talking about specifically the culture of fashion. Think about fashion as like as a language, right? Like, learn how to read other people's clothing, learn how to read trends, learn how to read why they were popular at the time, you know, why they went out of fashion, whatever. And then also to like develop your own vocabulary within the context of like a cultural operation, like, you know, cultural artifacts in many cases, well, culture generally is this active thing, right? Like, obviously there's objects which are, you know, like in a museum or whatever, like stationary and kind of blocked off and in some sense become kind of like stale. But most of culture is this like active thing and everybody's participating in it and everybody has to use the same language, but you can kind of like also do your own thing a little bit.
Yeah, you can, maybe putting it this way, you can learn the language and then say what you want to say in that language, right? You don't have to say the same things that other people are saying, you know, as Thy Workwear, aka Derek Guy, the guy who writes, Derek Guy is the name of the writer, Thy Workwear is his blog. You know, he talks about clothing as cultural or as like social language, right? That when you are dressing in a certain way, you're sort of saying something, you're trying to communicate some sentence, right? An ensemble is a sentence. The particular articles are like words in it, right? The sentence has to make sense, and the sentence makes sense by virtue of the syntax of the words, right? The arrangement of the ensemble. So you can't just put whatever you want on. It's not as if, you know, everything is just subjective, which means it's arbitrary. You do have to make sense. But in order to do that, you have to learn the language, which means go out and observe how people are doing things. That's why he talks first and foremost about find an aesthetic. Basically, pick a language that, you know, vibes with you or that you want to speak, and then learn to speak it by experimenting, by seeing what other people are saying with it, what it can and cannot communicate. It's a really good kind of like microcosmic analogy for what Bordeaux is talking about, right? That you kind of have to jump in a little bit.
In some ways, fashion in particular is a really good way of thinking about like the codex on a popular scale, because fashion is obviously an aspect of culture that, you know, we basically all participate every day.
Yeah, more or less.
Right? Like I'm pretty sure I know I don't, and I suspect most of our listeners don't leave the house every day naked or say, you know, whatever, right?
Maybe there's some like ancient cynics, you know, who are nudists.
Renounced all clothing, yeah, for sure. And they probably would be listening to the show if they were listening to any show on the radio. But no, we all wear clothing, and we all like, and most of our choices are pretty banal. Most of our participation in the culture is pretty. You know, we let other people in a sense decide for us. We kind of do it unthinkingly. But then there are those who, you know, really understand the codex, But also, too, it's a great example because, like, if somebody's walking down the street and somebody's wearing, like, a boot on their head and with a giant leopard print onesie or whatever, 99.9% of us are all going to look at that person and be like, that's a weird outfit. Like, that does, like, what is that person doing? What's going on with them? What's wrong with them, etc.? All based around the outfit itself, because we all have, almost all of us have, like, some relatively good understanding of the codex of the language of the culture of fashion that we all currently live in. Most of us is pretty base, but we all, like, have some, like, a basic capacity, right? Like, so it's a really good example of that in operation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we all kind of basically have, you know, the capacity to learn, like, the more particular forms of it in adopting, like, an aesthetic. But we all understand that, like, shirts kind of cover your torso, pants cover two legs, you wear shoes on your feet, stuff like that. That's all very basic. I mean, it's funny you talk about, like, a boot on your head or something and it just being, like, incomprehensible. I immediately in my mind comes, do you know who Vermin Supreme is? Even though it's a sort of, like, nonsense move, you very quickly understand. And there's almost, like, this experience of, like, a parody vibe just kind of, like, entering any discussion that he's in politically, right? He, you know, he is a walking caricature of politics, right?
Yeah, and he's communicates also
that through his dress.
Yeah, he's a walking caricature of culture, too, at the same time, right? Like, by he's obviously someone, if people know who Vermin Supreme is, he's a performance artist in the United States, effectively. He does a lot of political performance art. But, like, he is also, like, subverting the culture by doing that, by wearing a boot on his head and dressing like a complete wizard weirdo, you know. But, again, like, everybody in the room picks up on that, right? Like everybody has that cultural codex, right? Most of us don't have a very complete reading, and that's where you become kind of like an elite. That's where you build good taste, is when you have, you know, that complex reading, that complex ability to interpret that comp, and then also to that personal touch, right? To kind of add it and make it your own, that you become like someone who's deeply competent in some area of culture. And still, I think Buddha thinks that some areas of culture are more valuable than others, right? Like, you know, if you are adept and, you know, accomplished and understanding in the culture and world of finance and, you know, business relations, then you're probably going to be have more economic and cultural capital than someone who's adept at, you know, beatboxing. In every cultural aspect or avenue, there is this code and language that you got to understand, and you can kind of professionalize it in a way and become a sort of like elite in that cultural field.
I like Derek Guy's use of Bordeaux in that he's interested in not really like saying which particular form of taste is higher or lower, just that there are tastes, and if you want to learn how to do them, this is how you do it. Think of it like a social language. He really leaves it up to the person's personal inclination to be drawn to a particular aesthetic or a particular sort of style. And kind of reflecting the fragmentary situation that we find ourselves in, right? Where things seem a lot more relative, but we still have these feelings that, no, like, there really is such a thing as beauty. Like, I can tell an ugly outfit from, like, a well-put-together one, right?
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Yo, it's Eboshi.
Hey, this is Eboshi from Cartel Madras, and you're listening to CJSF.
I was on the back of your mind, I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car, you were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do, take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin, don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant, don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was like 34 double D's, you know what I like. Ice cold.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, BC.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.